this has been a difficult thing for me to put into a workshop. This subject of contentment has been a life lesson for me. And so I'm coming at it from a very personal point of view, and you might not relate to some of the examples that I'm giving you, but I think we'll get through to the principles as we go through. But this is going to be personal because I don't quite know how else to go through it, just sort of in lists of do's and don'ts I haven't got. But we'll see how it goes. Well, let me just tell you a little bit about myself, because the background of where I'm coming from is going to help, I think, with the rest of the material that we've got. My husband and I got married in 1963, and Donald was in business for 10 years, very successfully. We were then invited to join the staff of the Navigators in London, which we did, and we worked there for 5 years until we were invited to come here to the headquarters, and Donald's in the international part of the Navigators. Well, we had been here 4 years, and it was time for us to go home on our first furlough, which is a time of sort of renewing your roots and trying to raise some more money, because that's what we all have to do, and just strengthening relationships and just being with the family. And we'd been there for 3 months. But backtracking a bit, when we first came in 76, I had a feeling when I came here that I had come home. Now, I've had some Americans say to me that has happened to them in reverse. But I came here and I felt so comfortable and so at home that when I returned from that first furlough, I was utterly amazed that I didn't want to be here. I don't know what it was. Maybe the novelty of living overseas had worn off. I don't know what it was. Maybe the trip had been more than I had thought it was, and that I really felt comfortable in England, and I don't know what it was. But I was very surprised. And it was at that time that this seed of discontent was sown in my life. I was I was dissatisfied with a lot of things. First of all, with myself, in that I had put on a lot of weight in the 4 years I'd been here. You know what it's like when you go to different states or different countries. You try everything and you get hooked on certain things. And I was overweight, and it depressed me. My three closest friends, and they were three friends with whom I could share everything. And that's very unusual, I think, to have three friends in the same city as you are that you could have that depth of relationship with. They all moved away. And then my house didn't seem to be quite what I wanted, and the furniture didn't appeal to me very much. And then I got dissatisfied with Donald's job. He wasn't dissatisfied, but I was. And then it started sort of moving in on me that I didn't have as much money. I started looking back to the years of business and thinking that in those days I could have anything and do anything that I wanted to do. And that came in on me. And then my health started to deteriorate, and I had some bronchitis and two bouts of pneumonia, and I found four lumps, two under my arm and two in my groin. Let me give you some definitions. Could you pass one of those back to the lady who just came in? Thanks a lot. This is your own Webster's definition of contentment. Being happy enough with what one has or is. Not desiring something more or different. A restful state of heart. A sense of complete satisfaction. Having every need met. Leaving nothing to be desired. What I have just described to you, you can very obviously see that my life didn't connect with any of those definitions and was in fact the very antithesis of of what you know that Paul said in Philippians 4:10 to 13, where I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you have had no opportunity to show it. I'm not saying this because I'm in need, for I've learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who strengthens me. And that gave me a real encouragement as I looked into... I knew that verse. I've known it ever since I became a Christian when I was 20 years old. And it just came back to me at that time, and I got tremendous encouragement from it, that it was a process, that it's not something that you just become, or that you become at this moment. There's a process to be worked through. And we know it's possible by the promise in verse 13. Well, let's look a little bit into the process. We're going to look at the causes of discontent, the consequences, and the cure. If anyone, I believe, had any good reason to be discontented, it was Mary, the mother of Jesus. She was a virgin, probably, we're told, in her mid-teens and engaged to Joseph. Let's look it up. I want you to open your Bibles at Luke 1. We're going to start at verse 26, a story you know very, very well. In the sixth month, God sent the angel Gabriel to Nazareth, a town in Galilee, to a virgin pledged to be married to a man named Joseph, a descendant of David. The virgin's name was Mary. The angel went to her and said, "Greetings, you who are highly favored. The Lord is with you." Well, Mary was greatly troubled at his words and wondered what kind of greeting this might be. But the angel said to her, "Don't be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. You will be with child and give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. His kingdom will never end." "Well, how will this be?" Mary asked the angel, "since I'm a virgin." And the angel answered, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. So the Holy One to be born will be called the Son of God. Even Elizabeth, your relative, is going to have a child in her old age, and she who was said to be barren is in her sixth month. For nothing is impossible with God." "I am the Lord's servant," Mary answered. "May it be to me as you have said." And then the angel left her. What would you have said? Have you ever thought about it? If God was to come today and tell you you were going to bear the Messiah, what would your response have been? Good, yes. Who? Me? Yes, absolutely. Yes. What other ones could you imagine yourself saying? Right. Yes.
In my mind, it should immediately lead to the consequences, you know, what will family be, my mind would have thought down the road, more than the disbelief of, God, you can't do this, you know, how am I going to cope with this?
Yes. Yeah, right.
Big frustration. What some would be able to that me for this. But are you really considering my best interest? How could this be good for me or something?
Yes. Good point.
Or something like, why now? Because she would be true.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I guess I'd have thought, well, what's Donald going to think? Or what Joseph is going to think? What's the church going to say? What will the navigators say? How can I possibly raise a child in these circumstances? There has to be another way. I mean, it would be easier today to raise a child in those circumstances, but in Mary's day, it would have been a terrible thing. She probably would have been an outcast, I don't know. And I guess I would have said there has to be another way. And that's probably why God didn't choose me, but chose Mary. But Mary had no selfish thoughts for herself, because she goes on to say, let's read on from verse 46, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has been mindful of the humble state of his servant. From now on all generations will call me blessed, for the Mighty One has done great things for me. Holy is his name." Why do you think Mary was able to respond in that manner? I believe the next few verses are going to give us a clue. Let's go read on from verse 50. His mercy extends to those who fear him from generation to generation. He has performed mighty deeds with his arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. He's filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. He's helped his servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and to his descendants forever, even as he said to our fathers. Mary knew God. She just didn't know about him. She knew him in a personal way, and I think the way that she is able to record those things, that she understood what a mighty person this was. She obviously had a lot of knowledge about him. She was remembering what he had done for Israel. And I think that relationship was the basis on which she could accept this particular, opportunity? I don't know how she would call it. J. Oswald Sanders, the head of the China Inland Mission for many years, has said this: you are as close to God as you have chosen to be. Not as you wish to be, but as you've chosen to be. And me today and you today have the relationship with God that we have chosen. And I believe that that is the beginning of the process of being content. I think it's the foundation for victory. I don't know about you, but when I became a Christian, I was 20 years old, out of an unchurched family. And God seemed to answer my prayers in those first few years in an abundant way, very specifically, and more than I could sort of ask or think. And I think as I've grown older in the Lord, that is not necessarily the way, because he's taking us through the journey to learn to trust him in a deeper way, to allow that we don't understand things, but to trust him. And I think that that's where Mary had got. But by that stage, she'd learned to trust him, and she knew that whatever he brought along, because of what she knew about God's character, was enough to carry her through and to know that she could trust him. Well, what would make you content today? Now, I think contentment comes and goes. I think some of you sitting out here can probably be absolutely contented in every area of your life today, and some of you will not be. And to some it'll be one thing, and to others it'll be an enormous list. And for me, as I related, I had quite a long list of things that I was feeling discontented about. But if you are feeling discontent, what do you think it would take today to turn that around? Just write, take a little time, write down one or two things. Anyone brave enough to share with us one or two things that you've got? And how you're feeling about it?
I just think for myself, usually if I'm discontent, it's because I'm not believing God for what he says.
Mm.
And that if I believe he has my best welfare at hand, then I can choose whether or not I'm going to believe that. And I might not feel and be all excited about it.
Right, right. Right.
But I can still feel to believe it and ask him to give me that sense of contentment.
Well, that's great. That's good, yes. Interesting.
And it's really interesting because
That's good. Any others? Yes, I can see it would be. Yes, that's an interesting discontentment. I think there are different kinds from just what we've heard here. Mine is not on that particular level, but that's an interesting level. Maybe we can think about that a little bit more towards the end. Well, I don't know what you've written down, whether it's material things or relationships or money, a dream home, a loving husband, any husband, perfect children. I've been discontented with one of my children for some years. Better relationships, a new body. That was something that really was a big thing for me. Grumbling against God because I have the sort of body that puts on weight so quickly. And that's another grumble. But thinking further ahead as you've listed those things, if you received all the things that you're looking for, do you feel that that would make you content? Today, next week, next month. And then the other question I think is, can you be contented if you don't receive any of these? Well, let's look a little bit into the causes of discontentment, which we're going to read out of 1 John 2:16, and I'm reading out of the New International Version. Everything in the world, the cravings of sinful men, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. Vernon Grounds, writing in Christianity Today, points out that these three categories cover the whole realm of worldliness. Covers the whole spectrum of worldliness. So we are all of us going to fit into these categories. One, two, or maybe all of them. And for me, I have fitted into all of them. And at the same time in my life, I've had all three. So we're looking into the cravings then of sinful men, which in other translations would be the lust of the flesh, which equals sensualism. It's the selfish gratification of our physical nature. The selfish gratification of our physical nature. For me, it was wanting to do something that I couldn't do. And at that time, it was to travel with Donald when he traveled. Donald's in the international side of the Navigators, and he travels a great deal. And as I would look around, I would see that other navigator wives were traveling with their husbands, and nobody ever invited me to travel with Donald. And I became very jealous of the other navigator wives. Well, I rubbed shoulders with these wives often. What do you think it was doing to my relationship with these women? Do you think they could sense that it wasn't a great relationship that I'd got with them? And I think back, you know, again to the Christmas story, that the angel said, not to Mary, but to the shepherds, that that we were going to have joy and peace as a result of Jesus coming. And I really found at that time there was no joy and there was no peace in my life at that stage. And being jealous of other people is not a feeling I want to have. King George V of England wrote in his Bible, "The secret of happiness is not to do what you like to do, but to learn to like what you have to do." And I had to learn to be content at that stage with the boundaries that God had placed around my life and to learn to like it. Do you want me to read that again, the King George? "The secret of happiness is not to do what you like to do, but to learn to like what you have to do." I imagine that all of us today feel that there are some boundaries that God has put around our life. If you can be honest and specific, just write one or two of those down against this. What are some boundaries that God has put around you? The second thing is the lust of the eyes, which is materialism. This is a big one for me. I think it's very difficult living in America these days. Materialism attracts me. I'm vulnerable on that level. I still am today. Materialism, the lust of the eyes, is grappling for things that we want but don't really need or can really afford. It's grappling for things we want but don't really need or can really afford. It's the desire to possess things. For me, it came in the form of my house and my furniture. Now, do you have an annual parade of homes in your city? You all know what that is? Well, very disastrously, I went. And it was terrible for me. Because, you know, they have all the latest gadgetry and equipment and bathrooms and kitchens and colours, and I wanted to go home and change everything. There wasn't one thing I looked at that I thought I was happy with, and then I wanted to move the house because there were certain features that I suddenly realised I hated about the house. For one, that my sink looked at a wall. It didn't look out in the yard. It hadn't bothered me for 4 or 5 years, but suddenly it bothered me. The fact that when we're sitting in our living room, you went up a few stairs and there was the guest bathroom, so you could see them going up and opening the door, and I used to sit there trying not to think what they were doing. I mean, going up there and the door, and I got very distressed about that. They put the stairs to my family room. It had to be a man who designed this home, in a very silly place. It took you down from the kitchen and around past where the washer-dryer was, and a little sort of hallway, and then into the family room. And there was a much better access, which I actually made that improvement to the home, to come out of the living room and go down. But at that time, I couldn't bear it. And our bedroom and our bathroom were just about it. We could move, but that was about it. We could get round the bed, and it was suddenly, I couldn't stand it. And then the furniture. I have to give you some background on this. Both our parents, both sets of our parents, were affluent. And Donald's grandfather owned the last fleet of tea clippers to sail out of the Port of London. And they had been around the world many times, and his grandfather was a collector. And they had got some wonderful things. And when the grandparents died, Donald's mother and the other children got in for first pickings, and then the grandchildren, like Donald, got in for the second. Well, the second, you could hardly distinguish from the first. They were all so fine. And so we had a lot of beautiful pieces and some very expensive paintings that had been displayed at some of our more prestigious galleries. Well, when we left England to come here, the government at that time would only release to us $10,000. I don't know why. They've changed that since, but it was about, I think, 5 years after we came that they changed it. So with $10,000, we had to buy our home, we had to buy a car, we had to get the furniture. So you can imagine what the furniture looked like. It was no thing of beauty, and it didn't satisfy me in any way. So that's how I grew to hate it. And my only one hope was that because it was so cheap, it would wear out quickly, and of course it didn't. But you know, I would wake up in the mornings wondering how I could change it. It was my first thought, was how can I get Donald to change this furniture? And that took away my joy and my peace. And G.K. Chesterton once said, there are two ways to get enough. One is to accumulate more and more, and the other is to desire less. There are two ways, G.K. Chesterton said, there are two ways to get enough. One is to continue to accumulate more and more. And the other is to desire less. Now, the reason I had to buy the cheap furniture was that as we were making the move over here, the Lord did not provide us with the money necessary to make the move. And so we had to sell our antiques in order to make the move. And I guess when I had gone back after 4 years and the sort of excitement of being here had sort of worn off, I guess, and gone back and seen some of the furniture that the rest of the family had, when I came back, I think that I just hated it. Nothing had quality to it that we had been able to afford. And it didn't look like real wood, and the drawers didn't move. You know how fine furniture, the drawers just move beautifully. And so it was that I didn't have that, and then came back to what I had had here. Is there something like that in your life today? Jot it down against this particular section. The third thing is the boasting of what he has or does. It's the pride of life or it's egotism. It's a self-centered hankering to inflate our own egos. A self-centered hankering to inflate our own egos. It's a desire to achieve, to be successful, or admired. A desire to achieve, to be successful, or admired. Well, for me at that time, it didn't center around me because I was home with the girls. This is now we're back in America. But it was Donald's job. Now, Donald is perfectly content with his job. It's like a glove fitting his hand, is how he describes it. But I didn't think he was getting enough recognition because he's a behind-the-scenes man. He doesn't like to be up front. But I thought, well, he'll get more recognition if he can get up front. And so I began to sort of maneuver and try and sort of persuade Donald to take on some more speaking things. And it was not for his sake. And today I still do struggle. A lot of his work goes out under someone else's name. And I have this real craving to have this little line. It could be in very small print, but just as long as it acknowledged that it was he who had done most of this work and not the man who had signed it. Donald wouldn't care if any of his work went out under his name. He's perfectly content, but for me, I still struggle with that from time to time. And so I was, and I think, of course, it comes from the job that Donald had. He had a good job in England before we joined the staff. He was climbing the ladder. We had a lot of socials to go to. He had a title and a position, and we had our own chauffeur. And if I could bring one of those things back, that would be the one. There is nothing like the luxury of being chauffeured around. And for me, I think that's where it came, that I was comparing what he had with what he had now. It wasn't enough for me at that time. Well, Proverbs 21:9 says, "It is better for a man to live in a desert than with a fretful and contentious woman." Well, I had a daughter who went to college in California, and we had to drive through this Nevada desert probably 2 times a year. Well, you know what a desert's like. It's parched, it's arid, it's nearly lifeless. But God says that it was better for Donald to be there than living with me, pushing him into areas that were to inflate my own ego so that when you asked me what Donald did, I could give you a title and I could give you a big explanation, and it would inflate my own ego, because I guess I really had not realized how much of my security was in his position and his title. And so I was discontented. And of course, taking away his joy and peace as well as my own at that stage. There is a Danish philosopher who wrote this around 1900. "A flock of wild ducks were flying south at the onset of winter. One looked down, saw a farm where the domesticated ducks were feeding at a trough, and decided to drop down. He sampled the grain, and it was very good. So he stayed the night, and then he stayed for a few days, and then that ran into a whole year. Well, the next year, he saw his friends, the wild ducks, flying south again, and he tried to rise to join them, but he was too heavy to fly. The following year, he barely noticed them, and eventually he ceased to look up at all. Amy Carmichael has said, 'Beware of what you set your heart upon, for it shall surely be yours.'" There is... when you think of the children of Israel, and they're walking to get to the promised land. I've lost my reference here. Give me a moment. I'll come back to that. I think it will come up later, and perhaps in a better place. It's also said that sheep can get lost simply by nibbling away at the grass and never looking up. They can be true of any of us, that we can focus so much on what's immediately before us that we fail to see life in the larger perspective. Sheep are silly animals. And we are referred to in the Bible as sheep. We are silly animals. Our tendency is to put our head down and nibble. Colossians 3:2 says, "Set your minds on things that are above and not on earthly things." Well, we're going to look at some consequences here. Discontent is not a thing to be taken lightly. It is not what you would call a little white lie. And I think we're going to see why that is true, the consequences. The first thing it does, and remember, I'm coming from a personal viewpoint here, and there will be other things that I'm sure you could relate to, but this is where I relate. The first thing that I learned was that it leads to scheming and deception. Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately corrupt." Well, have you ever stayed awake at night wondering how you could do something or get something until it becomes a sort of obsession with you? I hope you haven't, but I certainly have. And I have planned during the day to see where I would put this new furniture. And I would draw sketches of the home that I wanted to move into until it became an obsession. Well, each of us is particularly vulnerable to certain temptations. And what is a temptation to me might not necessarily be one to you. But when we're faced with it, when it enters our lives, it evokes responses from deep within us. And if we fix our minds on them, we begin to rationalize and justify them. Well, Lord, that navigator wife is traveling with her husband. That navigator family's got nicer furniture than I've got. It's only, why shouldn't I? It's only fair. If they can afford it, why can't I have it? You begin to rationalize, and then you begin to justify it. And it becomes increasingly dominant in our thinking. And I think what we have to do is to learn to recognize them and then learn to avoid them. For instance, I never go to the parade of homes. And Donald is ecstatic about that. For you, it might be different. For you, it might be looking into that that clothes store where you really can't afford that quality of clothing. But you're going to look anyway. There might be something on sale. You might be looking at jewelry that you wish you had a diamond ring. You could imagine, it could be traveling. You look into brochures wishing that you could go here, there, and the other. When you know it's going to disturb you, avoid it. And that takes willpower and some self-control. But I don't see any other way that we're going to. It's like walking into temptation. And we don't want to do that. I want you to turn to the book of Joshua. Chapter 7. Now we are still under the heading here of leading to scheming and deception. I want you to read the whole chapter, Joshua 7, and I want you to identify the steps that led to Achan's scheming and deception, and then record the results. We're looking for four steps and the result. I'll give you some time to do that. Exceedingly angry. Go on to verse 18. Tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed. If only we had meat to eat, we're better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat and you will eat it. You will not eat it for just one day or 2 days or 5, 10, or 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and you loathe it because you have rejected the Lord. And chapter 14, verse 22. Not one of the men who saw my glory in the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on earth to their forefathers. You see, if we go on grumbling long enough, God will often give it to us. But what comes with that? A loathing. Scripture says. Turn to Psalm 106, please. Psalm 106, starting at verse 6. We have sinned even as our fathers did. We have done wrong and acted wickedly. When our fathers were in Egypt, they gave no thought to your miracles. They did not remember your many kindnesses, and they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. Yet he saved them for his name's sake, to make his mighty power known. He rebuked the Red Sea, and it dried up. He led them through the depths as through a desert. He saved them from the hand of the foe, and from the hand of the enemy he redeemed them. The waters covered their adversaries. Not one of them survived. Then they believed his promise and sang his praise, but They soon forgot what he had done and did not wait for his counsel. In the desert they gave in to their craving, and in the wasteland they put God to the test. So he gave them what they asked for, but sent a wasting disease upon them. And other translations say gave them leanness of soul. You know, we can sometimes get what we're after, but there are consequences, and we can become lean in soul. Home life, the third thing, home life can be affected. Proverbs 15:27 says, a greedy man brings trouble to his family. Put in woman, a greedy woman brings trouble to her family. Because I had been going on for quite a time, and Donald is an extremely patient man. He very rarely raises his voice or gets angry. So he allowed me to go on, and I guess I took advantage of it, until one day he said to me, in order for you to have what you want, he said, I need to leave the Navigators. Because in the Navigators, I can't afford to give you what you're asking. Now, if I had pursued at that point, I think he would have done that. But with what leanness to my soul to shoulder that responsibility and to have to answer to God for that particular decision that Donald made. Home life is affected. The fourth thing is it can affect our appearance and our health. Proverbs 14:30 says, a heart at peace gives life to the body, but envy rots the bones. And you'll remember that I had been quite ill with those, probably over a period of about 8 months. Well, after all that gloom and despair, we do have some hope. And we're going to move now on to the cure. The first thing we have to do is to recognize that the source of contentment is God alone. Psalm 145:16 says this, you open your hand and satisfy the desires of every living thing. We are bombarded today, aren't we, by the media, with offers to make us more attractive, more successful, more acceptable. And every single one of them is aimed at making us discontent. It prompts us to go out and buy, and thereby they say, yet you will be content. Well, if you use the right perfume, do men come running after you with bunches of flowers? Or if you're sucking on the right breath deodorant, do you have romantic encounters with men in elevators? We wish it could be true, but it just doesn't happen. And I fell into this trap last year in a big way. I was 50 last year, and one of the more expensive cosmetic companies were doing free facials in the mall. And I thought, well, 50, I'm very aware of all these little lines and things. Maybe there is something. I'll just go. I'll just go and have it done. They could perhaps give me a new look. And in I went. I was in the wrong place because I know I'm vulnerable in that sort of area. I was in the wrong place, and it serves me right what happened next. Well, they did my face, and I came out looking all right. I can't say it was wow, but it was all right. And when I got back, they'd lined up all the products they'd used on my face, and there were probably... And I said, did you really use all that on my face? Yes. Do I really need all that? Yes, you do. I said, well, how much is it all? How much do you think it was? Over $350. What do you think I did? I bought it. Now, I don't have $350, but I do have a credit card. And at that moment, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable. I'm sort of not wanting to do it, and yet I'm thinking, well, maybe it'll help. And so I handed it over and I signed it away. Now, was I happy? Did I have joy and peace on my ride home? How was I going to tell Donald? What was he going to say about $350 spent on makeup? I was not contented with my purchases. I kept them for a few days and I used one or two. And in the end, I was just overwhelmed with sort of guilt. And I took them back and I said, I'm sorry, but I just can't afford all this makeup. And they took it back. And then I told Donald what had happened. But what got to me? That makeup could make me feel contented about the wrinkles that were coming? Just fell right into the media trap. I'm not acceptable the way I am. But what does God say? In Psalm 81, 13 and 16, God says, if my people would listen to me, if Israel would follow my ways, if they would be fed with then they would be fed with the finest of wheat and with honey from the rock, I would satisfy you. You've all heard that quote of Pascal, saying that in every person there is a God-shaped vacuum. Nothing from the world can fill that. There's always going to be that empty space if we're not filling it with God himself. Donald hadn't noticed any of the wrinkles, he told me. He still thinks I'm the most beautiful woman in the world. Now, I know I'm not, but he thinks I am. The next thing we have to do is to seek God and confess your discontentment as sin. 1 John 1:9 tells us that if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just, and he will forgive us our sins and purify us from all unrighteousness. Why do we need to confess it? What is it we're doing? Am I grumbling against God because I've got lines? That's what I'm doing. That I've got the sort of body that sags. grumbling for how he made me. Grumbling for what he'd given me. Grumbling for where he's placed me. And sometimes, not for me, but for some of you, maybe for whom he's placed you with. Well, what can we do about it? We can ask him to change our desires. We can ask him to remove them. We can ask him to satisfy them. Or we can ask him to give us grace and power to endure. And I've had all four of those answers, depending on what that particular discontent was. We need to pray with David in Psalm 51:10, create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Then the next thing we have to do is to accept ourselves, our role, our circumstances, but not grudgingly. Not, oh, well, I guess this is the lot I've got. I better make the best of it. But with joy. Major on what we can do and what we've been given and do it well. Did any of you see the film Chariots of Fire? The Scottish missionary Eric Liddell, who ran in the Olympics, he said this in the film, God has made me fast, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. God's made us all something. And when we're exercising and developing it, we're going to feel his pleasure and we're going to find pleasure in doing it. Let me read you just a little bit out of Hindsfeed on High Places. Do you know that book? About little Much Afraid. One thing, however, made a special impression upon Much Afraid. In all that great... Oh, excuse me. This chapter is called Detour Through the Desert. It's just at the end of that chapter. In all that great desert, there was not a single green thing growing, neither tree nor flower nor plant, save here and there a patch of straggly grey cacti. On the last morning, she was walking near the tents and huts of the desert dwellers, when in a lonely corner behind a wall, she came upon a little golden yellow flower growing all alone. An old pipe was connected with a water tank. Well, in the pipe was one tiny hole, through which came an occasional drop of water. Where the drops fell one by one, there grew the little golden flower, though where the seed had come from, Much Afraid could not imagine. for there were no birds anywhere and no other growing things. She stopped over the lonely, lovely little golden face, lifted up so hopefully and so bravely to the feeble drip, and cried out softly, "What's your name, little flower? For I never saw one like you before." The tiny plant answered at once in a tone as golden as itself, "Behold me, my name is Acceptance with Joy." Much Afraid thought of the things which she had seen in the pyramid, the threshing floor and the whirring wheel and the fiery furnace. Somehow the answer of the little golden flower which grew all alone in the waste of the desert stole into her heart and echoed there faintly but sweetly, filling her with comfort, and she said to herself, "He has brought me here when I did not want to come for his purpose. I too will look up into his face and say, 'Behold me, I am thy little handmaiden, Acceptance with Joy.'" Then she stooped down and picked up a pebble which was lying in the sand beside the flower and put it in a purse with the first altar stone. One little drop that occasionally came through, but Acceptance with Joy. Jeremiah 29:11 says, "I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." God has sovereignly worked in your life and in my life to make us who we are and what we have and to put us where he's put us. And if he's going to successfully lead us through that plan, we've got to learn to be contented with the road that he's taking us along. The last thing I think is the key to praise and thank, is the key is praise and thanksgiving. I think this is an attitude of the victorious Christian life, but I think we have to make a conscious choice to do it. Both contentment and coveting are controlled through our minds. It's choices that we have to make. We have to choose not to be in the wrong place. But if we happen to be there through no fault of our own, we have to learn to avoid and to take whatever ways and means that you discover that you can avoid falling into this temptation. So what can we do? Maybe some of you can share here. When that feeling of discontentment comes, let me give you a few things that I think we could do, and you can get some others, to make a commitment to thank God for all that he has given. There is a real resource in journaling. I don't journal every day, but I do record times when God has performed and given or taken significant times that I can look back on God and track his faithfulness to me. And I think that we can do that when the temptation comes, like the children of Israel failed to do, to look back and to see how God had brought them out of captivity. They failed to look back. We must learn to look back. I think we can put on a joyful Christian tape. We could call a friend for encouragement. What other things could we do? Or have you learned to do? Yes. Yeah. Right. The Psalms are outstanding for this because most of David's Psalms start in distress. But then as he goes through, he speaks his heart out, which is what we have to do. Then he remembers who God is and what God has done. And he ends up by praising him. So there's nothing wrong in our screaming out, "I can't stand this." But it has to work through the other process to then look through to who God is and read in his word, even that Psalm 107, as it goes back remembering God's goodness and bringing us to his feet again as to he has every right to lead us where he wants to lead us. And I think just to finish with, and then we can discuss some things if you have got any questions, the story of a climber who fell off the cliff, and there was this proverbial branch that was just sticking out so conveniently for him, and he grabbed hold of it, and he knew he was going to fall. So he called out, "Is there anybody up there?" And he heard this deep voice that he assumed was the voice of God, and this voice said, "Yes, I'm up here, and I'll help you, my son." He said, "But first of all, you've got to trust in me." And he said, "Oh, I do. I absolutely do. What is it that you want me to do?" And the deep voice said, "Let go of the branch." And there was this very long silence. And then the man said, "Well, is there anybody else up there?" That's what we do, isn't it, though? That's what we do. When God takes us out on a limb and things seem impossible and dangerous, we look for an out. And I like the illustration of two oxen yoked together, pulling a heavy load. If one of those oxen is pulling against the yoke, it's going to hurt his shoulder and it's going to rub it raw. And that's what we do. We pull. We don't want that yoke around our shoulders. But if we're walking in straight with the Lord, then the burden doesn't seem so light. Have you ever had a sort of heavy thing that when you pick it up by yourself, it breaks your back? But if two of you, one on one side and one on the other, it's as if there's no weight there at all. And I think what we have to do is learn to walk with that yoke, yoking us to Jesus Christ, and coming back to the scriptures and to ask God to make us women of contentment in a world that makes us and aims at making us discontented. Do you have any thoughts or questions?